For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning. We have a great combination this morning of some regular ancient dragons and a number of new people, particularly welcome to the new people. For those of you staying for tea, maybe take an opportunity to introduce yourself to some of the new people. They may have questions, or you may have things you want to share with them. So, as I mentioned, Taigen is away. He's in Pittsburgh at his 50th high school reunion, so I can't wait to hear how that goes. I'm sure we'll hear about it. And he asked me to give the talk today. My name is Kyoshin Laurel Ross, one of the priests here. So this is going to be another talk about aging and death and Zen. And I hope it's not depressing or sad or upsetting. I seem to do one of these talks on this topic every year around this time. It could be that it's fall, you know, the days are getting shorter, it's getting cooler, or it could be that it's my birthday coming up in a few weeks. It's another reminder that time is passing. So a couple of years ago, a few of us started a discussion group on this topic, the topic of aging and death. And we're all Buddhist practitioners. We're not all Zen practitioners, but we're all pretty serious meditators. And we're sort of the opposite of the not-so-ancient dragons. So I want to talk a little bit this morning about some of the things that have come up in this group, but mostly share what I've been exploring in this regard. So we're not only a discussion group, but we're also a sitting group. And all of us are over the age of 50. Most of us are quite a bit older than that. I myself will be 70 in a few weeks. And my sister Diana just turned 60 last month, and she described it as a surreal experience. And I know exactly what she means by that. But I've been thinking about this number since I turned 69 last September, and I looked at what I wrote in my journal that day. I wrote, "The first day of my 70th year, I like to count my blessings on my birthday and on New Year's." So then I sort of enumerated what I was thinking of my blessings, and I started with good health. So I have good health for a woman my age, as my doctor always says. I also noted that I have a fair amount of discretionary time. I'm retired. And so that means that a lot of my days and my nights are my own, to spend the way I would like to spend them, which doesn't mean I'm not busy. And it doesn't mean there aren't demands on me, but I don't have to waste too much time on stuff that I really don't like doing. So that's great. The third thing I mentioned is that I'm relatively solvent. I'm definitely not rich, but I don't have to worry about eating or sleeping in a comfortable bed. And then the last thing is that I have friends and loved ones. And so that's a lot, and they're not necessarily in order of importance or value to me, but I'll come back to these in a little bit. I wanted to say that one of the things we've been doing in our aging and death sangha, as we call our group, is looking, sort of exploring this literature on aging and death, and we're looking for things that have Buddhist or other spiritual perspective on this stage of life. And I'll just stop for a second and talk about language here. the word that people are starting to use that I like is elderhood. It's sort of like parallel to childhood. I like that word. It's a lot better than some of the alternatives, which are senior citizen, oldster, golden ager, crone, gaffer, geezer, geriatric, codger, duffer, fogey. I mean, there's a lot of words that I just don't relate to and don't want to relate to. But uncomfortable with elder, it seems accurate. And unbiased, you know, non-judgmental, it just is what it is. So one of the books that I've been reading, and that one I don't have here because I lent it to someone, it's written by a Zen teacher named Lou Richman, and it's called Aging as a Spiritual Practice, a Contemplative Guide to Growing Older and Wiser. And so this was published in 2012. And I'll just read you one paragraph from that book. So he says, 40 years ago, when my Buddhist teacher, Shinryu Suzuki, was in his mid-60s, and the students around him were mostly in their 20s and 30s, someone asked him, "Why do we meditate?" And he replied, "So you can enjoy your old age." And we all laughed and thought he was joking. Now that I'm the age he was then, I realize he wasn't joking at all. Some aspects of growing old can be hard to enjoy, and a spiritual practice can definitely help. So that's the main topic of this talk, basically. Some aspects of growing old can be hard to enjoy, and a spiritual practice can definitely help. And it's also my attempt to make this talk relevant to people in the room who aren't over 50. So wisdom from Suzuki Roshi, who you may know was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, which is where our teacher received his training, and which has resulted in a flowering of many Zen centers all over this country. So it's also Buddha's wisdom. And when he was teaching 2,500 years ago, he was teaching his followers about loss and change, and that this is basically inevitable, more or less inescapable. But for some reason, this is hard for us to get our minds around, hard for us to really grasp, hard for us to accept. So when our group has its all-day sittings, which we do, you know, every few months or so, we've chosen to begin our all-day sittings by reading aloud from this teaching from Buddha, which is, it's usually referred to as the Five Remembrances. And there are lots of versions of this, but I'm going to read the version offered by Thich Nhat Hanh in his Plum Village chant book. So Five Remembrances. When you deny the reality of life, you appreciate it less. Meditate on the Buddha's five remembrances and rediscover the magic of life just as it is. I am of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. I'm of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. I'm of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. So, in summary, everything we love and cherish is aging and declining and eventually will disappear, and including ourselves. And at first that sounds very, very bad. everything is aging all the time. But try not to feel bad about it for right now, and sort of consider that, consider it as not actually a bad thing, but just something that is. Try to think of it neutrally as something that is. So Richmond, Lou Richmond, who I was quoting earlier, calls this getting to this awareness of our aging, he calls this a stage of aging. He calls it lightning strikes. He says this is the moment when we wake up to the fact that we're aging, and he sees this as very positive. He makes this point that it's never too soon to wake up to this fact that we're aging, and that when we do wake up, first of all, we wonder how it was that we didn't notice this before, because it's pretty obvious. But that it helps it helps us to live our life a little differently. And then he actually talks about four stages, of which lightning strikes is stage one. And then the other three stages are number two, coming to terms. So this is when we start comparing ourselves to how we used to be. So usually negatively, you know, I used to be really slim. I didn't used to wear glasses. I can't remember anything anymore. I'm now wearing hearing aids, and so on and so forth. So that's coming to terms. And then the third stage is adaptation, which is letting go of who we think we were or who we were, and embracing who we are now. And then the fourth stage he calls appreciation, which is acknowledging that this is my life. I have no other. So I think that the blessings that I was calling, you know, in my journal that I was listing, good health and lots of time and so forth, I think this is sort of in the direction of stages three and four, that I am working on adaptation and appreciation. So I used to worry about work all the time. Now I'm freer to spend my time as I like. So I don't have time, it's a short talk, to go into his whole discussion, but I do think he has a really good handle on this journey, as he thinks of it, to understanding about this important thing. And I'm finding that after the lightning strike, which is a great image, the other stages are, it's not a linear process, like then you go to two, and then you go to three, and then you go to four. It's really sort of doing all of those things simultaneously, and they all sort of help each other to realize themselves. So a second book, a wonderful book, and this one I do have, and this one is also in the library because I really liked it, and I mentioned it to Tigan, and Tigan knows the author and suggested that we put it in the library. It's called The Five Invitations, and it's written by a man called Frank Ostaseski. So he was one of the founders of the Zen Hospice Project, which started at San Francisco Zen Center 30 or so years ago. And the subtitle of this book, so it's The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. And the content of this book is his stories. He has attended at the deaths of over 1,000 people in his career as a caretaker, a hospice caretaker. And it's many, many stories of those experiences. It's really... Let me just read you from his introduction, because there's really limited time and I could go on and on. He says, life and death are a package deal. We cannot be truly alive without maintaining an awareness of death. Death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. I think that's the way a lot of us think of it or have thought about it. It's always with us in the marrow of every passing moment. She is the secret teacher hiding in plain sight. She helps us to discover what matters most. And the good news is we don't have to wait until the end of our lives to realize the wisdom that death has to offer. And he continues to say, our work is to move this understanding from our intellect and to nestle it deep in our hearts. So both of these teachers, both of these writers of these books are saying that reflection on death and our own death is an essential spiritual practice. And they see it not as morbid, but as life-affirming. And I'm pleased to say that it's starting to feel that way to me. Last week, I attended two different memorial services back-to-back, Sunday and Monday, of two friends. And they were both people I care about, I admire, respect, and definitely going to miss them. But I came away from their memorial services inspired by their lives. And many people said in many different ways that they had led lives that were well-lived, which I'd sort of like that way of thinking about it. Let me tell you a couple of things I heard. So Barbara, people said, she lifted me up, and I want to be more like Barbara. One person said, Barbara taught her that the definition of real fun was working hard on something important. I love that. And then I learned from her husband that she had a personal mission statement. I didn't really know that people had personal mission statements, but I like that idea. And her mission statement was she dedicated herself to making the world more nourishing, just, and humane, and had made something she referred to as an impossible promise, which is promising to do something that you don't expect will happen in your lifetime. And her impossible promise was to achieve racial justice and equality, and justice and equality for women and girls of all races. So that reminded me a lot of the four vows that we all recite together after our sittings. It's not something that we necessarily think will happen in our lifetime, but something that we would dedicate ourselves to. And my other friend, Tom, here's a couple things people said about him. He had very few idle conversations. Isn't that great? It's really true. He never wasted time. He was generous, authentic, a man of sterling character. One person said she still remembered his wedding, which was many years ago. At his wedding, she said he had such a broad smile that never left his face that she never saw someone so wholeheartedly give himself to a relationship and be so happy about it. So for both of these people, you know, I came away feeling like, you know, I'd lost something I really cared about. But, you know, it made the world a better place, and it really was inspiring, and I was glad that they had lived and that I had known them. So anyway, so another book. So this is not a Buddhist book, but it's an interesting book. It's by a woman named Mary Catherine Bateson, and it's called Composing a Further Life, The Age of Active Wisdom. So her mother was Margaret Mead, which I'm sure you've heard Margaret Mead, and her father was Gregory Bateson, who's a less famous anthropologist but a Zen practitioner. He actually died at the San Francisco Zen Center back in 1980. I don't know too much about him, but I'm an ecologist, and I had always heard this quote from Gregory Bateson, so I'll just read it to you to give you a flavor of her father. He said, "The major problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature works and the way people think." So that's a very favorite quote among ecologists. So her main idea in this book is elderhood, although she doesn't call it elderhood, she calls it adulthood too, which I think is sort of a stupid name, but anyway, that this is a stage of life, just like adolescence is a state of life and childhood is a state of life, and it should be recognized as a stage of life. It would help us do well in that stage, you know, just like acknowledge it and purposefully think about it as a stage of life, because we do have, most of us, our families are raised, many of us have retired from our jobs, so as in adolescence, we get to make another decision about what we want to be or what we want to do or how we want to be. And the difference, though, she says, in adolescence and adulthood, too, is that in adolescence, we got, a 16-year-old trying to figure out who they are. In adulthood, too, we have someone who has a lifetime of experience informing this, these decisions, these choices about what to do. And her advice is to compose your life, to actually think about it purposefully, and to get the most out of it, because eventually it's going to end with ill health or whatever. So the last book I'll mention is called Older and Wiser, Classical Buddhist Teachings on Aging, Sickness, and Death. And there's three authors, four if you count Buddha, because there's a lot of sutras in here. So one's a Theravada scholar, one's a Korean Zen practitioner, and one is a lay Buddhist teacher in the Thai forest tradition. So it's sort of an array of traditions. And so sutras on the topics of aging and death and related topics are presented, and then reflections are given by each of the authors, and then questions for thinking about these sutras and reflections are offered. So I'm only starting to dip into this book, but I'm finding it to be very good, and I think I'm going to suggest that we maybe put this in the library. We'll see what Teigen thinks of that. But it seems like a really a sort of like guiding a discussion group or even a reader on how to think about some of these things, which maybe aren't so easy to think about. So I want to bring up two more things before I stop and we have our discussion. And one is the topic of death poems. So some of you probably know that traditionally a Zen master, when he's very close to death, would write a poem that would be in some ways summarizing the wisdom of his life, a gift to his students or his disciples. I'll read you Dogen's death poem. So Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, his years were 1200 to 1253. And I've read a couple different translations of this, but here's one. 54 years lighting up the sky, a quivering leap smashes a billion worlds. Ha! Entire body looks for nothing. Living, I plunge into yellow springs. So I don't think Suzuki Roshi wrote a death poem. I looked for one. Do you know? Does anybody know? I looked for it. I couldn't find one. But I had this quote that I thought I would turn into his death poem. Treat every moment as your last. It is not preparation for something else. So to me, that works well as a death poem. So I'm not sure I'm going to write a death poem, but I've been thinking about writing an obituary for myself, which I know it sounds a little crazy. And then I thought, oh, this is crazy. And then I spent about 15 minutes online, and I found out everybody's writing their own obituary. In fact, there's a word for it. It's called auto-obituary. And it's like a trend or a trendy thing to do. So anyway, you can get tips on how to write a good auto-obituary. And one of the tips is use humor, which I thought was funny. But my favorite tip, this is my favorite tip, which I think is good advice. Plan for an exceptional obituary. Live an interesting and meaningful life. that is, I think, what we want to get out of this. I mean, that sort of summarizes why we are thinking about this, at least one reason we're thinking about this. And my last thing to mention is a short article I read in the New York Times in the last couple weeks, and then I posted it on Facebook just sort of casually, and it got way more response than I ever imagined it would. And what it was about was how adult kids, do not want their old parents' stuff when they die. That they don't want their silver and their china and their furniture and their anything. They don't want it. And that we should all get rid of our stuff and not burden our children with it. And the article actually talked about all this industry that's arising around stuff. You know, you can actually hire people for hundreds of dollars an hour to get rid of your stuff for you, unless you have it in storage, which is a $37 billion a year industry in the U.S. for stuff that we're all storing that we're not using. So that's another piece of advice for us. Don't collect stuff. So I'm just going to end with a quote from Dogen about how to live that I think sort of summarizes what I've been learning about how death and aging can help us live well. Dogen says, "Once you have clarity, do not neglect a single day. Wholeheartedly practice for the sake of the way and speak for the sake of the way. We know that Buddha ancestors of old did not neglect each day's endeavor. You should reflect on this every day. Sit near a bright window and reflect on this, on mellow and flower-filled days. Sit in a plain building and remember it on a solitary rainy evening. Why does the passage of time steal your endeavor? What kind of enemy is the passage of time? How regrettable to waste your time because of distractions. If you do not know yourself, you will not be able to be your own ally in this great undertaking." So thank you very much. I hope that was not too, what's the right word, morbid? It wasn't intended to be that. And I'd love if there were discussion, questions, comments. Paula.
Can you talk a little bit about the 20 years between 50 and 70? You know how the older you get, your years go by so fast. At least I'm experiencing that. Like each year that I'm older, the year goes by like a blink of an eye. The 12 months seem to go by like 6 months. So did that 20-year span seem like a long time to you?
So that's an interesting question for me, because that 20-year span, it's basically about 20 years that I have been a Zen practitioner. So in some ways, right around when I turned 50 was when I started grappling with this stuff. You know, time is a very hard thing to talk about and to think about and to, you know, understand at all. I find sometimes time stands still. I mean, it's just different. It's, but I have to say, I mean, this sounds like a commercial announcement for Zen meditation. And, I mean, in some way, although I'm not being paid, I really feel like a Zen practice helps that not to be true, that time just does not continue to, more rapidly race by. But it is different every day. I mean, sometimes you're sitting on the bus and the next thing you know, you've passed your stop. Time just went by. It's a really wonderful question. We should think about more about that. What do other people think? Has that been... I mean, I think we've all had the experience that when we were 5 years old, the summer seemed to last, you know, forever. And this past summer probably went by faster than the summers that we remember when we were children. It's worth thinking about. I think Mary Oliver has a poem about it, but I can't quite remember what her insight was, unfortunately. Do other people have comments on that? Yes. Oh, or on something. Yeah, Brian.
Something else.
Go ahead.
Well, what were the four stages?
Yes. After lightning strikes?
Yeah.
Coming to terms when you compare yourself to how you used to be. And then adaptation, letting go of who we used to be or who we thought we used to be, and embracing who we are now. And then appreciation, which is basically saying, this is basically it.
Well, my question really is to younger people here. I was trying to remember, as you were saying that originally, I was trying to remember what it was like to be going through a big transition when I was in my 20s or 30s. And I'm wondering if anybody in that time of life here can relate differently to those stages than, you know, loss of hearing and some of the other examples of aging.
Yes. Say your name. I don't know you.
Yeah, I just came. My name is Cameron, and so I am 22. I just graduated college.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It has been a very dense last couple of years of growth and change. I think the biggest thing for me that has helped with all of this is for now 2.5 years, or almost 3-4 years, I've kept a daily journal.
Oh, yeah.
And so that has really enriched and gave it a density that I could not have anticipated when I began. And I was reading stuff from basically a year ago, and where a period where I lost a lot of friends and learned a lot about myself that was very unpleasant. And it was very helpful to sort of see how I was growing through that at the time, and then to be able to reflect back on it and realize that change was for the better, even if it was very difficult in the moment.
Oh. Thank you for those comments. What are you going to do now?
I am working at the library at my university for the summer, but I have 1 more week of that, and I am blissfully unemployed and figuring things out from there.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Have a great life. Howard.
Is that a practice that's changed my perception of time considerably?
Yeah.
I'm still young, and I know that. I like to joke around like I'm getting old, right? And I am, but I'm also still young. I mean, but I already definitely do notice, like, oh, my body's changing a little bit. Like, I'm not hearing like I used to. My bees are already acting up a little bit. definitely a noticeable change from even a few years ago. But I'm still extremely forward moving. I'm still very forward moving. This idea that, like, oh, if I do these old person things or something like that, I'll somehow have more wisdom, I'll have more knowledge, I'll be more okay with myself or something like that. I'm still very much moving on that track, and, you know, it's still with a lot of assumptions and expectations about what it means to get older. And I'm almost looking forward to that moment when I don't look forward as much anymore as look back at my time being young as being great times. Because I'm still looking at my previous years and being, oh, man, I was an asshole.
We all were.
I'm still very much like, no, that was bad. Let's go forward. I'll know better at that point. And, you know, part of it is also just me sitting with, expecting a lot from getting older. I'm putting a lot of investment on getting older and somehow being better just because I get older or something like that. And I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. And you know, some of you are going to go through a huge change.
That's it.
One thing I really love about this practice is that it kind of clarifies this relationship between consciousness and time. It seems that the more I'm able to slow down, the more the rest of the world seems to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I really, that interests me a lot is in public places, looking at the difference between how much time people my age seem to have versus how much time people who are in elderhood seem to have, just demonstrated by the way they kind of go about things. And it seems that people my age have very little time. And people of an earlier generation seem to have a lot more time to actually experience life. And I would love to kind of move the question back to other Sangha members and ask, is that something learned through experience, or do you feel that this kind of busyness has come to a new level in this period of history? I see a big difference, and I'd love to know how you guys experience that.
Who wants to take a crack at that? Brian? Douglas?
I will.
Paula?
I know no one thinks I'm that old, but take care. This is unique to our times because of technology. Because at no other time have we been so connected to everything going on in the world, which is a good thing and a bad thing. But I think people that are older realize that the choices you make go a long way into how you manage your time. And we decided to use technology more because as it evolved, we could plug in and plug out. Where younger people, even younger than you now, didn't have that choice. So it's a revolutionary time in humans' existence. And what does it mean? I don't know. But for those of you, I think, that are the age of, like, Howard's a little older than you, I think.
We should line up according to age.
Yeah. I still think that you can, through practice, slow down, take a breath, and decide when you want to add technology to your life and when you don't, and that you'll get a lot of freedom by making that choice. But you can't ignore it. And we even know that too, those of us that might have been neo-Luddites and all this technology kept. We can't ignore it either. But it's a different and unique and challenging time for the human race, I think. So.
I think we're going to figure it out, but maybe not in our lifetime. I mean, it'll get figured out. You know, last night I was dinner with a friend who was her 77th birthday party. And so she said, she wakes up in the morning and she doesn't feel like, she says, I feel unmoored. I don't know what I should do all day. And I was so sad. You know, so just because you have time doesn't mean you're going to use it well, you know, that it's going to be the solution. It really takes some work. You know, we had a good conversation about it, but that was a sad thing for me to hear from a person who had a really great life. I mean, she was a labor organizer her whole life and, you know, lots of cool things that she... Why should she wake up in the morning and feel unmoored? You know, what a great world we have. So that's, you know, sort of what this talk was about. It makes sense for us to not just let this happen, but to pay attention to it. Was someone else going to say something over here? Were you going to say something, John? Did you have your hand up? You don't have to, but...
I was just thinking of stuff.
Go ahead.
In the old generation, people used to buy stuff with cash.
Yeah.
And they were afforded. Now we have this society that I want it now, and I'm going to work for it. I'm going to put it on a credit card. And, you know, like, I want to put it all in debt and housing and financing cars, and that makes us more like we're slaves to the stuff we own that eventually owns us.
Yeah, and then your kids don't even want it.
Yeah, like, that's my point. Like, talking to a lot of people in the old days. I mean... The average car, I mean, just in a matter of like 30 years, has gone up dramatically from financing. Everything's financed.
I saw a movie and this summer and Netflix it with Shirley MacLaine where she wrote her own. It was
oh, yeah.
Terrible. I forgot the name of it. She wrote her own. She hired a lady that wrote obituaries to write her obituary before she died.
Okay.
And she's like this rich, crabby, yucky old lady, but she's not that way really. And it turns out that they go on a trip with a little. Poor little, real young black girl, and it's really a lovely movie, and but she hired
Did
her.
Did she change her life so she'd have a better obituary?
No, they went on this trip just because they went on a trip.
I see. Okay,
and
got it.
The whole thing was for her to have her write this girl to write her obituary before she died.
All right, I'll look it up.